My guest today is New York Times bestselling author Phyllis Karis, whose powerful book, Curse of the Blumenthals, uncovers a gripping true story of family tragedy and generational trauma, from immigration and prohibition era bootlegging to a shocking murder that shattered a family legacy. Phyllis brings both a journalist's eye and a personal connection to a story that asks, can a family truly break free from its past? Curse of the Blumenthals is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for everything about Phyllis, go to Phyllis Karis, K-A-R-A-S, phylliskaris.com, and you can follow her on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And Phyllis, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Ira.
Pleasure. So in your introduction in the book, you wrote, I wear the word cousin as a badge of honor. Why?
I do, because it was instilled in me from as far back as I can remember that my cousins were very important. We made tons of family meetings, sessions together. And even if we were living in different states, we always communicated. We were almost like brothers and sisters. And there was a bunch of us.
That's a great explanation. I like that. Yeah. Because there are families where cousins are, well, they're distant or they lead separate lives. They're not hostile necessarily to each other, but they don't stay in communication on an ongoing basis. Maybe a car.
Yeah, that wasn't allowed.
Yeah.
In the Blumenthal family, it wasn't allowed. We continued. We were together no matter where we were living.
And you, something else in your book, you said, my imperfect, this is a quote, my imperfect, cursed, brave, loving, and adored family. End quote. That was part of what you were talking about. But what compelled you to dig into your family's history, and what is the overall arc of the book? It's an interesting title, but why did you decide to write this book? I guess that's a simpler way to ask the question. Why did you decide to write the book, Curse of the Blumenthals?
Oh, it's a simple question, but there's kind of a long answer to it. It was a story I always wanted to write. I've been writing other people's stories. I've been writing about crime mobsters. I've been writing about Hollywood celebrities. I've done lots of other stories, but this was my story, and I wanted to write it, but I needed to wait. I needed to wait until the time was right, and to be truthful, I needed to wait until one cousin died. And once he was gone, then I felt, okay, the path is here now. There's no more delaying it. It is time. It was a story about my life and two incidents in my life that guided everything that seemed to happen in the Blumenthal family. One was the incident. The first was the accident. The second was the incident. The accident was a car accident that killed six of my family relatives, including three children under the age of 12. It was committed by a drunk driver who rammed into my family's car and killed six people, six Blumenthals. According to my mother, this was always the accident, and everything in my life, kind of, or in her life, since I was not alive in the accident, which happened in 1936, everything in her life happened either before the accident or after. She would tell a story and she'd say, oh, yeah, well, that was a year before the accident. Or this was a year after the accident. It was the rod in which she measured everything. The second was the incident, which I guess we could call the murder, but my mother sanitized it and called it the incident. And it was a murder that was committed by one of my cousins. Those were the two stories. That was the arc of the story. And that's really what I wanted to tell.
When you decided to start researching this, and I know you talk with a lot of different experts, librarians, and genealogists, were you also relying on the rest of your family for information?
Yes, I would say it was 50-50, maybe 75 family, 25 genealogists. There was so much information that I had never really received. I was told stories, but they were not exactly as they happened. So being able to look into newspaper reports, going back to the 1930s was not that easy when you're trying to do that in the year 2020. But there are wonderful reports, and I was able to get librarians who are indispensable when you're doing research and get into all kinds of files that I ordinarily never would have found. So I could find out, quote, the truth, not the sanitized version of the truth.
Were they using old technology, microfiche, microfilm?
Oh, goodness, yes. I don't ever want to ever look at a microfiche machine again. It's torture. I mean, you can thank AI, you can thank the world. We really don't have to do that. I had to do that for a few pieces, but for the most part, I didn't. Thank heavens.
Not everything is digitized, so you had to go into the archives, into the archives. Did you get pushback from any of your current family when you said to everybody in your regular meetings with cousins and others, did you get pushback from anybody that said, well, there's no point in doing this? What was that?
That was my biggest fear.
Okay.
If one cousin said, I don't want to tell this story, please don't do it, I would have stopped because it's their story. I'm telling their story. And that's quite a responsibility. Luckily, all of my cousins were very supportive. They were curious too. They wanted to know. It affected them as well. I did lose three cousins while I was writing it. This was a four-year project, and I lost three of them who were in their late 70s, and that was heartbreaking to me. But they were with me, and some of them had wonderful. They had letters that I never knew about that they had kept. They had photos that I had never seen. They had stories to tell that they had never told anybody. So it was wonderful for me to be able to use them and to know that they were part of the story. It would have killed me if they hadn't been.
So you have a hybrid of both personal reference, meaning your cousins and other family members, and then the professionals, the librarians and genealogists, who provided, in essence, third-party information, more objective in a way, in some cases, to your story. So you had to synthesize both of those. So again, this is a personal project, but you're also a professional journalist and writer. How did you work that synthesis to be able to make it factual and compelling and not let your emotions get in the way?
That was hard because it was my story. You know, when I was writing a mobster story, it wasn't my story. I could tell about his murder, the crimes, what had happened, and it really didn't affect me. And yet everything I read about a cousin or an aunt or an uncle or some terrible crime that had been committed by one of my relatives or upon one of my relatives was so personal, and it was so different. And I've always thought of myself as a journalist and that I can be objective, but you really can't be that objective when you're writing your own family story.
Right.
And you're telling family members scenes and stories that they never heard about their own relatives. In particular, the accident, the car accident, the drunk driver that killed six of my family members, that wiped out practically one entire family. But two children were born after that who were relatives of them, and they never knew the true story. My cousins Dickie and my cousin Bobby never knew who drove the car that killed the two brothers and sisters that they never got to see. And this was something to be able to call them and say, I know the name of the driver, and send them all the reports and stories about him that I was able to research. So he wasn't just a figure in an article. I wanted to know about his family, his wife, his children. Who was this man that destroyed our family in so many ways? So handing them that was really a gift to them. As awful a gift as it would be, yeah. Here's the name of the murderer. It still was a gift because it filled so many gaps. I think every family has a story and has its secrets with tons of gaps in them. We don't tell everything to our family. We try it. At least my family, my mother especially, tried to sanitize everything. But the truth is there.
I think that's human nature. I don't think there's very few cultures where everybody's straight with each other in terms of family history. So there's usually somebody that's protecting somebody else or sparing the feelings of other family members. When you mentioned about the driver that you found out everything about him, did you take that extra step? And it's a interesting call whether to do it or not. But did you find family members of that driver, current family members that you talked to about the incident? And if so, were they distraught about finding out this they may not have known themselves?
That, Ira, was my biggest heartbreak. None of them were alive. Mm-hmm. The driver, his wife, his one child, children of his grandchildren, there was not one person. And believe me, I searched because I wanted it. I was able to get information about the other people that were in the car with him and find out stories. But again, there was no human being alive from that 1936 accident that I could call and I could say, do you have any idea what your father or your uncle or your brother did? I wanted to be able to make, it sounds awful, but I wanted to be able to make that, and I couldn't.
Yeah.
And
that really it almost good. Feels that part of it would be more, I could see it on the professional journalism side, but also a kind of closure on your personal
yes.
side as well. Yeah.
Yes.
When it came time, and there's a term people use, our audience may or may not be aware of, it's called beta readers, where once you finish a book, you have X amount of people look at it for comment to see if there's anything factually incorrect. Does it read right? Are there suggestions for revisions, etc.? When it came time for that, did you also submit to family members to read the book?
That's a very good question. And yes, I did. There were two particular cousins who asked so vehemently that there was no way I could refuse them. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad I did it. One was my cousin Fred, who was so crucial in so many respects. And I I broke my heart that he died a year ago. So he never saw the book in print. And that's tough. But he read it. So I'm so thrilled that at least he had the chance to read and commented and found things that he liked and didn't like. And any suggestion that he made, of course, I followed up on. But it was very painful for him. I remember him, and I still have the email that he wrote. I have to put it down. It's too painful tonight. I'll get back to it tomorrow. Yeah. You know, especially about the car accident. And I knew that. And I knew it wasn't an easy story for anyone to read. But I was grateful that my cousin Fred did get to read it and made comments that are still very much a part of the book.
Did others who read it that were not part of the family, that were more objective in a way, if that's the term, but who were reading it more for the literate aspect of it, the punctuation, grammar, factual inaccuracies, those kinds of things, did you get some feedback from them? Were there any things you had to change based on the response from the others?
Yeah, I did. I was very fortunate. I have a terrific agent, Doug Grad, and we had worked together. He had actually been my editor when I was writing another book for HarperCollins, and I trusted him because I knew what a wonderful editor he was. And he took the book very, very much, not just as an agent trying to sell it, but as an editor. And he made marvelous comments. And because I knew what an expert editor he was, it was great to be able to give it to him. I also just gave it to a friend who knew nothing, because I just wanted it for a person who knew me all my life but had no idea about these two particular stories in my life. And that meant a lot to me.
Were they surprised when they read the book?
Yeah. Phyllis, why didn't you tell us about this? Well, I didn't want to tell you that one of my cousins was a murderer.
Well, here you are, a mild-mannered mob reporter. And
I know. It was different when I was telling them, when I was writing about murders that Whitey Bulger committed while he was on the run. That was no big deal. But when I'm telling them my very own cousin, Ronnie, it was a big deal.
Yeah. Well, when you made the decision to, I go back to something I asked you earlier, how to synthesize the factual material you found out from third-party sources, plus the photos and letters and other information you got from family members. What was your process? I hate to use that term, but I don't know what other word to use. What was your process for putting that all together? How did you decide to structure the book? That might be a better
question. I should just let you see what's going on in back of me. All the pages and pages of newspaper reports and interviews that I had, and trying to mix that with other stories that I had, so that I wanted to make it readable, but I wanted to make it right. And I could not afford to be sued by someone said, but that's not how it was. I had to have the actual newspaper report in my hands. And then to try to find the editor and the author of some of these articles who were no longer living was a challenge. And then to get to the Globe or the Providence Journal and get them to confirm that this article was written at such and such a time and pay for a lot of these articles as well. That was enormous amount. I think I spent more time, I'm sure I did, researching and confirming things than I actually did sitting down and writing. The writing was nothing.
Interesting. Yeah. The fact that you have to do the spade work, the groundwork to talk to various entities, including, as you mentioned, newspapers who are not, this census is the 21st century. They're going to charge you for giving you any archival
material. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
For every photo.
Yeah.
For every newspaper photo, you know, you have to pay a price. And I understand that.
Yeah, as an aside, because I don't know how it is nationally, but more and more newspapers are slimming down to practically nothing. Do they still retain or maintain a library within the newspapers, in your experience, where they have the archives readily available? Or do you have to sometimes go to the university special collections and do that that way?
Yeah, actually, Northeastern University, which luckily has a library in Boston, seems to be an archiver and has so many of these old newspapers. And it was wonderful to be able to go there. And they had a terrific person who worked in charge of that unit and was able to help me get all the articles that I needed. And I am so grateful to these, because I could not have written it without him.
You know, it's a common thread. I talked to a lot of authors over the years. One of the common threads is their acknowledgement and gratitude to, and I don't think we give them enough, research librarians, head of special collections, et cetera, who know their stuff and can help an author in so many ways that you don't even realize till you talk to them and say, you know, I'm trying to find this thing about that. And they go, well, wait a minute, there's also this, this, and that.
And they're so wonderful, Ira, because not only are they all brilliant, I swear they are, but they don't charge for that. That's like part of their job. part of their job. And I would just send them a question, and I'd be amazed within 48 hours what they had. Of course, the Boston Public Library was wonderful also, and they were extremely helpful. But even my local librarians in a small little town north of Boston, Marblehead, was able to find me information that I never thought I'd be able to put my hands on. They're very bright.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I wanted to give a little shout out to the librarians.
Yes, thank you.
The interesting dichotomy for me is you're writing this book using, I'm sure, 21st century technology. In other words, you're not sitting there with a manual typewriter, but you're relying on information that in many cases comes from the 20th century. In fact, most of it does. And so you have to rely on, as we mentioned earlier, microfiche or microfilm and dusty collections of things. So do you find that, do you ever think to yourself how this interesting dichotomy between your writing technology and the yes, and what was there and it's still around?
Yeah, it's amazing because I could ask a question and sometimes AI would answer it for me. Mm-hmm. And other times I'm going back to literally dirty, rusty old files and looking up and a piece of information. AI doesn't know everything, but they sure were helpful in ways that I never expected to be. But with everything that I did, I had to double check.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've learned too with AI, you got to double check.
And
you
have double check.
You have to be very specific with your question. I once asked the question, they didn't have an answer, and I rephrased it slightly, and bingo, there was the answer.
So, isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it really is. Well, when you were writing the book, and how long did it take you to write the book? Once you researched everything, you're ready to go.
Well, the research was several years. I mean, it just seemed like it was endless. But the actual writing when I sat down was barely a year.
Okay, so about a year. Did you find yourself along the way, and it's a personal question, but I know that you're up for it. Did you find yourself occasionally when you're writing a chapter or a couple of paragraphs where it was very personal, you had to almost stop and give it a few days because you can't deal with that right at that moment, similar to what your cousin said, he had to put it down before he read the rest of it.
I truly did. I can't believe I never knew this. How awful. And then, especially when I was researching the murder that my cousin committed and trying to see some of the newspaper articles that were written about him were so horrible. And I tried to put that together with the cousin that I knew and loved and trying to weave it all into one piece. And sometimes I just have to put it down and say, I just don't know who was my cousin and who wrote these horrible stories about him and who was the victim and all these individual people. I wanted to know so much more. In many ways, it was heartbreaking that they were no longer alive, but maybe it was better.
Yeah. Do you think that it is, just so our audience knows, a slight delay with Zoom. So I don't mean to trip over you or vice versa. It just happens with a slight delay. Okay. Do you think that sometimes the shock of your cousin being a murderer is partly related in a cultural setting? What I mean by that is there are certain cultures, socioeconomic groups, where murder is more, I don't want to say commonplace, but if you find out a family member's in jail for a murder, it doesn't have the sting that it does in your world.
That's such an interesting question, too, because I was told so little when I was 8 years old when the murder was committed, and newspapers were hidden. And I remember picking up a newspaper from the Boston Herald American, and there was the picture of my cousin Ronnie, and underneath it was, "This is the face of a murderer." My parents had told me so little, and the trial was going on at the time. To them, it was a terrible disgrace that the name Blumenthal, that my cousin had committed this, and it was all over the news. And yet so many times when people have heard about my story, they have come over and said, "I had an uncle who served times in prison. I had a cousin who killed somebody." Everybody has these little stories that are so hidden, and yet it's almost like a piece of pride that, you know, my family did something pretty unique too. And just as a kid, from when I was, I think I didn't see my cousin Ronnie till I was 11 in prison. My mother and father thought I should be 11 before I went, and going into the prison and what that experience was like. And I kind of wanted to tell my friends, "You won't believe where I was yesterday," but it was a no-no. You didn't talk about it. So I didn't say, I'm going off with my mother for the afternoon, you know, going to maximum security prison, but didn't say that.
I guess that's what I'm leading to with my question, is that if in certain other groups, for example, or demographics, that if someone went to see their cousin or uncle in prison, it's a no big deal because they may have another cousin or brother in prison for something else. But in your world, this was very unique. That was the point I was trying to make or ask, which is that because the rest of your family was in no way in that world, and even though you've written about some of those worlds, that's where the impact, I think, is stronger than if you were in a family that's in a group or a location that's more common, it wouldn't have the impact it did.
Yeah, I found that when I was writing, for instance, about women who love bad men, that was part of my Whitey Bulger story.
Right.
And they were almost proud. The women would say, oh, yeah, I'm dating somebody that's in prison or whatever. It was, you know, a South Boston whole concept that there was nothing to be ashamed of. But I was from a nice Jewish family. Anti-Semitism was rife at that time. And it was not something that my parents were proud of or wanted to talk about. Yet they were there. They went all the time to visit Ronnie. Nobody turned their back. My mother always had this statement, and I loved it. After the accident, she would say, when you lose six members of your family in an accident, you're not going to lose any more. And that meant Ronnie. And no one was going to lose him. He was a Blumenthal. He was part of our family. He may have committed a horrible crime. That's also another question. Right. But we're not going to lose him. We're there for him.
Was he aware of that? In other words, when you came to visit or other family members came to visit him in prison, was he, I don't know what the word would be, would it be filled with gratitude, the fact that people were visiting him, family members were visiting him?
Well, you know, he's 18 years old when he went into prison. He came out when he was 33. That's a lot of years, a lot of different things that he went through. But we had to fight to get the time. I mean, the visiting hours were all filled. It would be another aunt or another uncle or another cousin. So we would say, you know, I was able to get next Wednesday at 4 o'clock or something, be able to get it. So he knew we were all there. And everybody brought food. That was the big thing. My mother was the brisket maker. So she would bring, you don't bring one brisket, Ira, you bring two. One is for Ronnie and one is for the guards. So you just have to make sure that there's two packages of strudel, one for Ronnie and right. one for the guards.
Did they check for knives in the strudel and make sure that weren't stolen?
I am sure they did. I am sure. We have no idea what happened after we would right. see Ronnie in the visiting room looking wonderful and happy.
Now, you did not answer my question. I always remember my question, no matter how polite I am. And that is, did he have a sense of gratitude that all these family members were visiting him?
It's a good question. I think so. Because every time we would come, you know, we couldn't kiss him. We couldn't touch him. Right. But he would always say, I cannot thank you enough for coming. I love you. And that was the greeting always.
Yeah,
and then when we would leave, thank you so much. I love you, Aunt Belle. I love you, Phil, whatever. And we felt that. And we knew it was important. And to my aunt and uncle, his parents, it was always the phone call. How did he seem? Thank you so much for going. When will you go again? And I kept that log
yeah,
of the prison
great.
Visits.
The book, again, is called Curse of the Blumenthals. And it's pre-ordered, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. When you started to write the book, after all of that research, did you feel there was a piece missing that you just had to either leave out or... that type of thing?
That is an excellent question, and one I'm not happy to answer, but I'm certainly going to answer it anyhow. My mother had always described the murder as more of an accident than a murder. My cousin he was 18, and he killed a 43-year-old seamstress who was doing some work for the family on their clothes. And he'd gone to pick up a raincoat, and that night he killed her. So they say we're still a question about whether he did it or whether he had help or someone else did it.
Right.
But my mother had always told me the story. Ronnie went to pick up, you know, Aunt Edith's raincoat, and something happened. I don't know what that woman said to him, but she must have said something terrible, and he pushed her, and she died. That was the story. Well, when I researched it, no, mother, that was not the story. Ronnie did not push her. He stabbed her, he strangled her, and he crushed her head. This was an act of horrible passion. This was not an accident. And that was the hardest thing. I read it over and over and over. My mother by that time was no longer living. And he called all of my cousins and we all discussed it. And it was just so painful. Some of them knew that it wasn't just a simple accident.
Right.
But accepting that, I was glad that when I started the book, my cousin Ronnie was no longer living because it would have affected everything. But
did
there it was in black and white.
Did any of the family members, when they visited him, ask him that question about what happened?
That's the elephant in the room. Okay. No one said it. We'd all come out afterwards and say, did you even think about saying it? We couldn't. We just couldn't get the words out. Mm-hmm. He looked so handsome. He was a very handsome man. And he was always dressed so. He never wore just a prison garb. My aunt always made sure that he has beautiful sweaters to wear for his visits in there. And you just couldn't say to him, hey, Ronnie, did you really do it? I mean, I thought about it, but I couldn't get the words out. I just couldn't.
Were there any family members that read your book and were negatively disposed to it?
Well, one relative said, I don't think there was a particular phone call that one of my aunts got from the state police telling her about the accident and how what had happened was the first person to get the news that they had been killed. And I had it written as that it was my mother that got that call. And a cousin called and she said, no, it was my mother. It was Aunt Esther. I'm sure of that. So it was very hard for me to make that decision. It sounds silly who answered the phone, but it was important to me to really find that out. So I did as much investigation as I possibly could. And then I finally just changed it to my mother and Aunt Esther both picked up the phone at the same time. It just seemed easier than to argue with my cousin about it. But it was important to her. And I can see that because it was important to me who got that call.
But in terms of the whole book, were there any family members after reading it? They were all in favor of you doing it, writing it. But after it came out, were there any that were uneasy?
I think one cousin who said, did you have to be quite so heavy on all the details of the trial? And yeah, I did.
You did.
And we had a long discussion about it. And I said, maybe you just could have made that chapter a little shorter. No way. There wasn't one detail I was going to leave out. It was there and I was going to write it.
Before I let you go, what's the one thing you'd like readers who are not Blumenthals to take away from the book?
I'd like them to believe that the curse that caused the accident, the curse that caused the murder, we were bootleggers. Alcohol was a huge part of it. But that curse, I firmly believe, is over. I think that it died with the last Blumenthal. I want to believe that. And I think that no matter how awful something is that happens to your family, no matter how painful it might be, there's a way out. And I think that the Blumenthals got out of it. I think the love and the support of one another and being cousins and loving each other can erase a curse. I truly believe that.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Phyllis Karras, author of Curse of the Blumenthals. It's available on Amazon on pre-order, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for everything about Phyllis, there's a bunch of books on the website, Phyllis Karras, K-A-R-A-S, PhyllisKarras.com. Follow her on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And Phyllis, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Iris. So appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. And join us every Thursday for a new Schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.